Hello, this is Tamara with the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, April 22nd. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. From Donette Beckett in Decatur, Arts and Entertainment, Generations in Harmony. We have a photo of Mount Zion Junior High 8th grader Tyler Stome and Apollo Lee, both trumpet players, greeting each other at the start of rehearsal for the side-by-side concert with the Decatur Youth Symphony Orchestra and the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra in Decatur on Monday, April 20th. The free concert will be Sunday, April 26th at the Decatur Civic Center. Decatur Concert to feature young, professional musicians. If you go, side-by-side free concert featuring Decatur Youth Symphony Orchestra and Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra. It's at 2 p.m. Sunday, April 26th, at the Decatur Civic Center. On the web, symphonyguildofdecatur.org. Holy Family fourth grader Esther Georges was asked to play the violin with other musicians, some more than twice her age. "My music teacher told me about it because he said I was really advanced," she said. "The learning experience of playing with professional musicians and other students like her has been fun," Esther said. "I've learned how to do sharps, naturals, and different flats," she said. Esther and other students in the Decatur Youth Symphony Orchestra will be playing along with the professional musicians of the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra during the free concert Side by Side on Sunday, April 26th at the Decatur Civic Center. The DYSO is made up of musicians ranging from grade school to high school students, with a few Millikan University musicians. "They're usually music education majors," said Grace Ports. "It's so a college student who has an educational perspective to try to give the students tips to be kind of a coach." Ports is the string coach for the DYSO, as well as a music instructor at MacArthur High School and Stephen Decatur Middle School. She said she is ready to help the students when needed. "Whenever they need to know about a specific technique that applies to violin or cello with a bow, it can get complicated," she said. Ports performs with both Decatur orchestras. "At 26 years old, she remembers performing with the youth bands. It makes me feel really old when I think back," she said. "It feels like so long ago." As a young artist, Ports said she understands the challenges. "A lot of artists struggle with confidence or self-critique," she said. "Something I like to say a lot is to play without fear. Be confident in the sound you make, because we all start somewhere." The students who perform with the DYSO have proven their talent, but we try to encourage them to make these brave artistic choices, Ports said. "When you are a young artist, you don't always have that experience to draw on." Tuba player Caleb Reed, 18, has taken advantage of other musical opportunities in the past, including playing in the Decatur Municipal Band. "I attended Millikan's Brass Day my freshman year," he said. "I'm used to the new experiences." MDSO's conductor Neil Smith witnessed Caleb's talent and invited the Unity Christian High School student to join the youth orchestra. "I actually started on the trombone a few years ago, then moved to the tuba," he said. Caleb's plans are to continue in the music field. "Band instrument repair, you don't hear about it that much," he said. "I needed to find a way to make money and keep doing what you want to do." Several of the professional MDSO musicians have worked in the music field or in education. "You help raise the next generation," said Karen Frost. "We all have this mentorship," added Christian Geiger. "It's important for the kids," said Shanoa Murphy. "It's giving them exposure. All three women are string musicians. We're here for them," Frost said. Caleb is one of the older musicians in the DYSO. He also offers words of advice that come from experience. "Learn all you can," he said. "It's an amazing experience." On page A3, we have photos of Mingzi Han and MacArthur High School sophomore Connor David on Monday, April 20th, playing the string bass during rehearsal for the side-by-side concert. A photo of Steve Shepper playing the French horn during rehearsal on Monday, April 20th for the upcoming side-by-side concert. And our last photo is of Grace Ports and Holy Family Catholic Church Family Catholic School fourth grader, Esther Georges, sitting down to start rehearsal for the side-by-side concert with both the Decatur Youth Symphony Orchestra and the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra in Decatur. Now from the city of Decatur, from Tony Reed. $5 million okayed to ring out lead plumbing. Atrocious Records, cloud scope of project, state to help with costs. The Decatur City Council has approved more than $5 million project to wring all the lead goosenecks out of the town's water system. A gooseneck is the nickname given to the S-shaped lead fittings once used to connect the city water mains to the water lines serving private property. In a memo to the council, Director of Public Works Matt Newell said every known lead water pipe the city ever had has already been removed. However, lead goosenecks and galvanized pipes were commonly used for water service lines installed prior to 1940 and are still prevalent in the system, Newell added. Exactly how many appears to be anyone's guess, however. Amid more than 30,000 water service lines, Newell said there are 6,670 suspected GRR service lines, galvanized pipes serving the goosenecks that may also have lead contamination, that need to be replaced. He told the council that at roughly $10,000 per service line, the potential cost impact is a staggering $67 million. However, it is likely that many GRR service lines have already been replaced, either on the city side of the curb box or the private side or both, he told the council. Past service line inspections or replacement projects have determined the city records may only be 20% to 50% accurate. Our records are atrocious. Taking that rather buoyant view, the City Council voted during its meeting Monday to accept a bid from Burdick Plumbing and Heating Company, which will be paid $3,979,000 to carry out enough gooseneck and galvanized pipe replacements it's hoped will drain any remaining threat of lead contamination out of the city public water main system. The council also agreed to spend another $287,560 to pay for construction engineering services to make the project happen, and with another $398,000 tacked on to allow for unexpected project expenses, the full bill comes to north of $5 million. The good news for city taxpayers is that the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency will loan the city the money to get the job done within 10 years. And it gets better. Loan terms for the city will see $2 million of the total forgiven, turning that part of the loan into a grant, and the rest gets paid back by local taxpayers at a zero interest rate. But there's some bad news, too. Lead service lines inside private property are the responsibility of the homeowner or landlord. Newell said the city has a program to help cover 50% of replacement costs for those internal pipes, but the typical bill runs to $6,000 or $7,000. So it's still a pretty steep slope, he said Monday, responding to questions from council members. Councilman Dennis Cooper feared it was a bridge too far for many cash-strapped homeowners. Can we look at increasing the amount, provide more money to them out of those funds from the loans, and reduce the burden that residents have to pay, he asked. We can look at that, Newell told him. Yeah, there's the opportunity to do that. Councilman David Horn wondered if this get-the-lead-out approach was barking up the wrong plumbing tree. Newell told him most lead contamination actually comes from a building's internal plumbing, and Horn noted that the Macon County Health Department has been dealing with more than 80 active cases of lead contamination involving kids under 6 years old. So how can we direct resources to mitigate the problem, which I would say is more acute, so that those families are protected from drinking lead-contaminated water? What can the city do? Horn asked. Newell said he didn't have an answer immediately to hand, and Horn said he understood it would take time to formulate a response. But from my perspective, it's the more urgent need, the councilman added. Continuing with local news, from Tony Reed in Decatur. City okays 4% raise for firefighters. Blaze near Oglesby Mansion looms before council vote. The City of Decatur Fire Department showed off their professional teamwork skills again early Monday, saving the historic Governor Richard J. Oglesby's mansion from the fierce flames tearing their way through that neighboring and vacant Henry Mueller home just a few feet away. It was the latest in an escalating series of fire calls testing the department in recent months, but there was some warmly pleasant news awaiting them Monday evening. The Decatur City Council signed off on the firefighters' latest pay and benefits agreement. Among the highlights are a 4% pay hike retroactive to January 1, 2025, and January 1, 2026, with further 4% raises scheduled for January 1 of 2027 and 28. Add a requirement for how far firefighters can live from the city they serve has been extended from 40 to 50 miles, bringing them in line with Decatur Police Department officers. Reaching a new pay deal turned into something of a slow burn, however. The firefighters' previous contract had expired at the end of 24, and city negotiations with the International Association of Firefighters Union fizzled out after 9 months, when both sides ran into what city manager Melissa Hahn described as an impasse. So it was time to call 911 and get an arbitrator on board. Believing an agreement could be reached, the arbitrator facilitated mediation sessions between the parties, Hahn explained, in a memo to the council. The arbitrator's award is the result of said sessions. The proposed collective bargaining agreement reflects the arbitrator's award and 18 months of bargained for terms between the union and the city. And as infernos like Monday's Henry Mueller conflagration in the 400 block of West William Street showed, firefighters are likely to be working increasingly hard for their enhanced salaries as the number of Decatur blazes continues to heat up. Fire Chief Neil Elder told council members in his latest activity report that his department responded to 3,552 incidents of all kinds for the first 3 months of 2026. Of those call-outs, 119 were classified as fire-related calls, and there were 50 fires alone in the month of March. By comparison, during the same three-month period in 2025, the department responded to 3,752 total incidents, including 92 fires, Elder noted. While the overall call volume has decreased slightly in 26, the number of fire incidents has increased. In previous comments, Councilman David Horn said a 29% jump in city blazes in three monthly statistics a year apart is a worrying trend. He says vacant homes and buildings are prime targets for arson, and Decatur has a large number of vacant properties, many of which he said are derelict and need to be demolished for safety reasons. Fire Chief Elder said the cause of the fire in the 118-year-old Mueller home, where the alarm was raised around 3:30 a.m., remains under investigation. Horn said Decatur's fire crews thoroughly deserve their glowing reputation. "Just want to say thank you to the firefighters for everything you do every single day. You were true heroes and amazing public servants." And there had been more praise in public comments before Monday's meeting got underway. Ann Owens, treasurer of the Governor Oglesby Mansion Incorporated Board of Directors, said she had fears at first the more than 150-year-old building was doomed. "I am going to tell you that for 4 hours I watched the firefighters do unbelievable work," she told the council. "I watched them as a team. We all need to be Team Decatur. And let me tell you, Neil, the fire chief, would be a great coach. I'm very happy to say that right now it looks like we did not sustain any damage, and that was definitely the work of our fire department." Meanwhile, interest in landing a job as a firefighter continues to be a hot commodity. Elder said a recent request for potential recruits saw that more than 100 applications come in. "The written examination and interviews are scheduled for May," Elder told the council, "and we anticipate establishing an eligibility list by early summer." From local and state news, Tony Reed, Decatur. Police mourn Sergeant Whitmer. Truly one of Decatur's finest, dies after fight with brain cancer. The Decatur Police Department is in mourning for one of its heroes, Sergeant Timothy Whitmer, 45, who died Saturday after losing a brave battle with brain cancer. Whitmer's courage had earlier been saluted on October 12, 22, when he was one of two officers shot and wounded after being attacked by a convicted criminal during a Decatur traffic stop. The bloody confrontation was caught on police body cam footage, and Whitmer had a passing bullet graze his face before being knocked to the ground by bullets hitting his hand and body. On the night of the shooting, Whitmer, a U.S. Marine who had seen tours in Iraq, had struggled past the pain and shock of being shot to clear his jammed service weapon and return fire, emptying the clip of his weapon at the suspect, Jamonte O'Neill, 32, who was killed in the resulting gun battle with Whitmer and several other police officers. Then Macon County State's Attorney Scott Reuter later ruled that Whitmer and the other officers involved, including Officer Austin Bowman, who was also wounded, were justified in the use of deadly force after Neal had fired first. Neal, who had previously served 15 years in prison for offenses including gun crime, was known to be carrying illegally owned weapons. When members of the police department's community action team, which targets gun crime, had intercepted him. Images posted by fellow police officers on Facebook show police lined up outside Whitmer's home recently to welcome him back from medical treatment. The officers and well-wishers filled the street and can be seen praying with Whitmer, who is seated in a wheelchair. A Facebook post from Whitmer's family said he had been diagnosed with a significant brain tumor in November. Well-wishers had formed Team Whitmer to raise funds to help the Whitmer family with medical and other expenses linked to his illness, particularly aggressive brain cancer called glioblastoma. Speaking Monday, Decatur Police Chief Brad Allen said Whitmer, who retired from the force in the wake of his wounds, will be missed. "We all at DPD mourn Tim's passing. Our thoughts and prayers are with his family and friends." The chief said he would not comment further out of respect for Whitmer's family. Speaking Monday, Decatur Mayor Julie Moore Wolf said her city and country had lost someone very special. "Tim was a great cop and he was a hero," she added. "He loved his family, he loved his kids, and was truly one of Decatur's finest. His death is just heartbreaking." The mayor had especially good reason to remember the night Whitmer got shot in the line of duty. Her son, Travis Wolf, then a Macon County Sheriff's Office deputy, had been assisting in the operation to arrest Neal. Officer Wolf, who now serves with the Illinois State Police, was caught up in the gunfire but escaped injury. The mayor noted Whitmer's previous service in the military and his willingness to continue to risk his life in the civilian world, serving with the city's police department. "He gave his entire life for his country, for his community," she said. "I mean, a life of service just doesn't get much better than this." Whitmer, who served in the police department for 18 years, leaves a family that includes his wife, Becky, and a young son. Funeral arrangements are being handled by Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home in Decatur and were not complete as of Tuesday morning. Now, the first column from our opinion page, the jury rebellion. You have a photo of U.S. Representative Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan and U.S. Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona speaking on Capitol Hill in February after a federal grand jury in Washington rejected an indictment against them and four other Democratic members of Congress, who posted a video advising active duty troops of their right to refuse illegal orders. Our first column from Abe Lowell and Stephen Salke. Ordinary Americans reject excessive prosecutions. The rule of law in America is facing an unprecedented stress test. The targeting of political rivals for criminal prosecution, facts and evidence notwithstanding, has drawn a lot of attention. But something else is going on. Federal grand juries and trial juries are exercising a renewed sense of independence, serving as a critical check on perceived abuses in the criminal justice system. For decades, grand juries deciding not to bring charges was unusual, because evidence is presented to grand juries solely by a prosecutor without a defense presence. The prevailing wisdom held that a prosecutor could indict a ham sandwich. That era appears to be closing. In some of the most publicized instances of the past year, federal grand juries in Virginia refused to indict the Attorney General of New York for alleged mortgage fraud, not once but twice, despite prosecutors seeking friendlier juries across different districts in the state. More recently, a federal grand jury in Washington rejected an indictment sought against six Democratic members of Congress who posted a video advising active duty troops of their right to refuse illegal orders. Data from the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers' Criminal Case Tracker reveals that these are not isolated incidents. Many grand juries nationwide are refusing to advance felony charges presented by federal prosecutors. This is likely happening more than we know, because prosecutors in several high-volume districts have reportedly delayed notifying courts of these decisions, or they are attempting to bypass reporting requirements. The juror rebellion extends to the trial phase as well. Faced with what many perceive as the overcharging of minor incidents, trial juries are returning not guilty verdicts at a high rate. For instance, after a grand jury refused to indict Sean Charles Dunn for a felony after he threw a Subway sandwich at a federal agent, prosecutors in Washington, D.C. used their authority to charge him with misdemeanor assault. A jury promptly acquitted him. This trend is particularly acute on the West Coast. Juries in Los Angeles have acquitted several defendants on charges they interfered with or assaulted federal officers when those cases proceeded to trial in 2025 and early this year. Furthermore, the speed of these deliberations signals a profound skepticism of the government's theories. In a recent case where a homeless man was charged with a felony for shining a toy key ring laser near Marine One, the jury returned a not guilty verdict in 35 minutes. Our nation's founders embedded the grand jury and the trial jury into the Bill of Rights precisely for this reason. They viewed the concurrence of impartial citizens, drawn from all races, ages, and political backgrounds, as the ultimate safeguard against a government misusing criminal law. While the use of the justice system to punish political enemies remains a dark chapter, the silver lining is the reawakening of the American people. This trend is not a legal quirk. It is a restoration of the jury's role as the final bulwark of liberty. This awakening should be celebrated by those on both sides of the aisle who value the rule of law over the rule of any single administration. Lowell represents several individuals who have been targeted in recent federal probes. Salke is an attorney and the creator of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers Criminal Case Tracker. They wrote this for InsideSources.com. Now from our national and world news page, from the Pentagon, Reuters, Washington. Shot no longer mandated. Soldiers won't need to get flu vaccine, part of administration push. The Pentagon will no longer require members of the U.S. military to get the flu vaccine, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Tuesday. We're seizing this moment to discard any absurd, overreaching mandates that only weaken our warfighting capabilities. In this case, this includes the universal flu vaccine and the mandate behind it, Hegseth said in a video posted on social media. The notion that a flu vaccine must be mandatory for every service member, everywhere, in every circumstance, at all times, is just overly broad and not rational. The decision scraps the public health requirement at a time when the Trump administration has broadly moved to scale back federal vaccine recommendations, including those for children. The military rescinded a COVID-19 vaccine mandate in 23 after former President Joe Biden in 21 ordered members of the U.S. Armed Forces to get vaccinated over objections of Republicans. Thousands of service members were discharged for refusing to get vaccinated. There are 1.3 million active duty service members, and there are more than 750,000 additional members of the National Guard and Reserve. The World Health Organization recommends the flu shot for those 6 months and older. Hegseth said that under the new policy, those who wish to get the vaccine would remain free to do so, but said, "We will not force you." The Trump administration faces a delicate balancing act, standing by millions of MAHA supporters who helped re-elect the president in 24, but are now upset by Trump's order to boost pesticide production while managing low support among the wider public for Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s anti-vaccine platform. Kennedy, who co-founded the anti-vaccine group Children's Health Defense, has, during his tenure, pushed to reduce the number of recommended childhood vaccines, replace the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention panel of independent vaccine experts with several members who share his anti-vaccination views and pledge to identify the cause of autism. Kennedy and his supporters repeatedly link autism to vaccines, a theory long debunked by science, at times with Trump's explicit backing. Pollsters and strategists expect health care costs to be a primary issue for voters who will decide control of Congress in November. From Howard Schneider, Reuters, Washington. Warsh claims no promises made. Federal Reserve nominee tells panel he plans broad reforms. Federal Reserve Chief nominee Kevin Warsh said Tuesday he made no promises to President Donald Trump about cutting interest rates as he tried to assure U.S. senators mulling his confirmation to lead the U.S. Central Bank that he would act independently of the White House while pursuing broad reforms. In a hearing that ranged from Warsh's calls for regime change at the Fed to contentious exchanges over his personal finances, the 56-year-old lawyer and financier said in his conversations with Trump about the job, "The president never asked me to commit to interest rate cuts. He did not demand it. The president never asked me to commit to any such thing, nor would I do so." Trump, who nominated Warsh for the top Fed job, repeatedly expressed his confidence that his pick will deliver lower rates if confirmed and said in a CNBC interview just prior to Tuesday's hearing that he would be disappointed if it didn't happen. Warsh is considered likely to be confirmed, but the timing of the Senate approval remains unclear. Republican Senator Tom Tillis, in an unusual turn, used his time during the hearing not to ask questions of Warsh, but to detail why he would delay the confirmation until the Trump administration drops an ongoing criminal probe of current federal chair Jerome Powell over a renovation of the central bank's headquarters in Washington. Tillis's hold on the nomination could leave Warsh unconfirmed and Powell remaining as Fed chief even after his tenure in the top job ends May 15th. In response to a series of questions from Democratic committee members trying to highlight potential distance between the nominee and Trump, Warsh declined to comment about the administration's various efforts to put pressure on the Fed, including the probe of Powell and the attempt to fire federal Governor Lisa Cook, a matter that is pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. He also refused to say that Trump lost the 2020 election, or to comment on whether the Republican president's call for interest rates to be cut as low as 1%, a level typically not seen outside of efforts to fight an economic downturn, made economic sense at a time when the economy is growing and unemployment remains relatively low. From Washington, Reuters, record gasoline surge boosts U.S. retail sales. Tax refunds helped raise spending despite soaring prices at pump. U.S. retail sales increased more than expected in March as the war with Iran boosted gasoline prices and led to a record surge in receipts at service stations, while tax refunds underpinned spending elsewhere. Though higher prices largely accounted for the biggest gain in sales in a year, the Commerce Department reports Tuesday prompted economists to upgrade their economic growth estimates for the first quarter. The U.S.-Israel war with Iran, however, cast a shadow over the economic outlook. Economists expected a considerable slowdown in growth this quarter as the tailwind from tax refunds fades and more expensive gasoline pulls spending away from other categories. Retail sales jumped 1.7% last month, the largest hike since March 25, after an upwardly revised 0.7 gain in February, the department's Census Bureau said. Economists forecast retail sales, which are mostly goods and not adjusted for inflation, would advance 1.4%. Sales advanced 4% on a year-over-year basis in March. Economists estimated only a 0.7 increase from a year ago when adjusted for inflation. Today in history. On this date, in 1889, the Oklahoma land rush began at noon as thousands of homesteaders staked claims to nearly 1.9 million acres of land that was formerly part of Indian Territory. By the end of the day, the cities of Oklahoma City and Guthrie were established with as many as 10,000 settlers each. From National News, briefly, ICE funding. U.S. Senate Republicans will move forward this week on a budget blueprint that would boost funding for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol agencies for the next 3 years, Majority Leader John Thune said Tuesday. The Gates Foundation opened an external review earlier this year into its engagement with the late financier and sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, the philanthropic group said Tuesday. The foundation has been mired in controversy due to Chairman Bill Gates' association with Epstein. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, April 22nd. Please stay tuned.